Ready, counsel.
I'd like to reserve a minute for rebuttal. Chief Judge Moore, Judge Bishop, Judge Auburn, counsel, may it please the court. As I was thinking about and reflecting on this case, I think that it came to me that a lot of cases in the law involve relationships, and when those relationships become broken, we turn to the courts. And in cases relating to real estate, there are different kinds of relationships. And in many instances, we have arm's length transactions and two equal parties who reach an agreement. In some other cases, though, we don't necessarily have two equal parties and an arm's length transaction. We have a situation, like we do in this case, where we need to create something called a constructive trust. Now, when we bring those cases before the courts, there are certain rules that we all have to follow. And one of those, of course, for the good order of society, one of those rules is a statute of limitations. The question, of course, is when does that statute of limitations begin to toll? We know that there are several different points at which this, in this particular case, the statute of limitations could begin to toll.
You mean begin to run?
Begin to run, okay, yes. I'm sorry. In this particular case, there was an agreement, apparently, an alleged agreement entered into in 2006. There was a subsequent agreement entered into in 2007. As part of that subsequent agreement, there was a provision that allowed a buyback of this real estate that expired in 2017. But we allege in our complaint, and we allege throughout this process, that my client, Sue Long, was a vulnerable person. She was very vulnerable at the time. As the district court pointed out, she wasn't under any disability. We didn't argue that she was under any disability, but disability does not, disability and vulnerability are two different things. She was vulnerable at the time. She had this trusting relationship with her lifetime friends. And her,
can I interrupt you for
sure.
A moment? So the posture of this case, first, as I understand it, the defendants filed a motion to dismiss.
Yes.
Based on the statute of limitations.
Right.
But then there was evidence offered, so it was converted to a summary judgment.
That's
proceeding.
Correct.
Did you offer any evidence in opposition to the evidence that was adduced by the defendants?
No, Your Honor. I relied on the pleadings, mm-hmm. and that my understanding that the court needed to take the pleadings as true.
I'm thinking of the proposition, though, that when there's evidence offered that supports the notion the case ought to be dismissed, that then it becomes your burden, it switches to adduce evidence to rebut that.
I understand that.
Okay. And I just want to be sure that I understand the record that there wasn't any evidence offered.
That's correct. There was solely argument. And again, we were relying on the petition and our understanding that the court needed to consider the allegations in the petition true.
Would you agree that if a constructive trust arose at the time of the initial transaction, and if your argument is that there was a wrong committed at that time, there was some kind of deception or fraud or misrepresentation, then the statute of limitations would have begun to run at that beginning point, wouldn't it have?
No, I believe that the law in Nebraska is that it begins to run either at that time or at a time when the person alleging the constructive trust knew or should have known. And she didn't know She didn't understand, and there was no way for her to know until she actually received an eviction notice from the house that she had lived in for 45 years.
Well, are you suggesting that if the trust grew out of a consensual agreement, then the statute of limitations would not begin to run until there's been a repudiation of that trust?
Right.
So there's a difference, though.
Yes.
Whether there was a wrong committed, if the wrong was committed at the time of the initial transaction, the statutes run on you. If there was a consensual agreement, then it would have started to run at the time of the repudiation, which you're arguing is when she was evicted.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I'm sympathetic to that argument, but for that purchase agreement. So can you reconcile the law that we've just discussed with that purchase agreement?
She hasn't had an opportunity to present evidence regarding that purchase agreement. The pleadings show that she alleges that she didn't know that there was an agreement, that her friends, her trusting friends, just set paperwork in front of her,
okay,
and she relied on
that. Okay, and I apologize, because I didn't mean the purchase agreement. I meant the option to purchase agreement.
Right.
Okay, that was executed a year later. So now right. She's had a year to kind of recover from this, you know, emotional mm-hmm. upset that she was in 2006. But a year later, in December 2007, she signs a purchase option agreement.
Mm-hmm.
How do we reconcile that agreement with a constructive trust?
Well, again, I think she was simply trusting her friends, and she did what they asked her to do, and she continued to pay them.
Why not just execute the option to purchase agreement?
She didn't have a copy. We didn't even know that existed until they raised it at the time of the motion for summary judgment. My client does not remember that.
But we don't know that from the record.
Right. Right. Ultimately, I think in this case, it is indeed a case about real estate. Indeed, we do need to be concerned about statutes of limitations. But ultimately in this case, it's a situation where this woman relied on long-term friendship. They came forward, they made an offer to her to help her out. She was so overwhelmed by that and so thankful. And several years later, she gets an eviction notice, and that's when she finally goes to see an attorney because she realizes that she has been duped, and she realizes that she has paid these people thousands and thousands of dollars more than what she thought she had borrowed. And I don't know how she would have known that she had done that unless she were sophisticated and understood what the documents were when they were placed in front of her.
Didn't your client admit she received at least one of the documents,
right?
The seller's closing statement?
That's correct.
Wouldn't that be sufficient to tip her off that she has sold her property?
I think it depends on the person. I don't think that everyone would understand that. And I think that's why we have constructive trust, because there are people who are vulnerable and there are people who are taken advantage of in a trusting relationship.
So in the complaint, then the payments are talked about in the complaint, because as you say, that's the only thing that we can consider as evidence from your side, is the $625 a month. You're
yes.
claiming those were, in essence,
she thought they payments. Were. Yes. She thought they were loan payments.
Loan payments.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Judge
Good afternoon.
Moore, judges. I'm Elizabeth Klingelhofer. I'm an associate here in town at Jacobson or Lindstrom in Holbrook. So I just want to personally welcome you to Kearney. This is awesome. It only took me 5 minutes to drive down here. And it also allowed me to extend a really unique opportunity to my mentee who's sitting here in the front row behind me, Ms. McNamire. She's considering going to law school. So just if I was her age and had this in town, that would have been awesome to attend between classes. So just want to extend a welcome to her. Turning to the case at hand, I represent the appellees in this case, or which I might collectively refer to as the Warnakes. And the relief we're seeking in this case is an affirmance of the district court's order, which found in favor of the appellees for summary judgment, barring the appellant's claim based on statute of limitations. As you've already heard, this is a case about statute of limitations, whether when it began to run and when it began to toll. And I think there's not just one argument that I have in this case, but two. That the statute of limitation begins to run when the wrong occurs or when the appellant becomes aware of when a wrong occurs. And when a wrong occurs and you want to toll the statute of limitation, the burden is on the appellant to show that there were previously unknown facts that she was unaware of that alerted her to the wrong that would have been underlying to bringing her suit. And the second, and she's judged under the standard of an ordinary person with intelligence, prudence, and acting with diligence. So just directing to your question, Chief Judge Moore, regarding the seller's closing statement that the appellant admits that she had in her possession in November of 2006, and when appellant's counsel stated that it depends on the person, that's not the standard. The standard is whether an ordinary prudent person would believe that seller's statement, which listed the property here as a sale price of $71,000, would believe that to be a sale or a loan agreement with a lien.
But documents by themselves don't defeat a constructive trust. Would you agree?
I would agree. It's the transaction as a whole. And the transaction as a whole, we can impute all four of those documents in November to appellant: the purchase agreement, the lease, the joint tenant's warranty deed, and the admitted seller's closing statement.
Are you familiar with the case of Waite versus Cornett up in 2000?
Yes, I believe I cited that in my brief for maybe a different purpose that you're bringing up, Judge.
Maybe, let's see.
Okay.
So in that case, there was a warranty deed executed in 1928 that the court held could have created a resulting trust. This was also a summary judgment case. But they contended that there were material facts as to that that would have defeated a summary judgment. And then there was another transfer in 1954 that they suggested could have potentially created a constructive trust. So in that case, in both instances of the transfer, there were warranty deeds executed that did not necessarily defeat the possibility of a constructive trust because there were understandings between relatives about how that property was ultimately to be distributed. So given that, and given that in Flory versus Crispin, which I believe you may have also cited, if a constructive trust grows out of a consensual agreement, then the statute of limitations doesn't run until that trust is repudiated, which appellant is arguing didn't happen until she was evicted because it was her understanding she would live there for her lifetime. So given that, and as I asked opposing counsel, I'm still trying to reconcile that purchase option agreement with this concept of a constructive trust. Can you help me with that?
Yep, Judge, and thank you for reiterating that Waite case. I understand. It's been a little while since I've read it, but I remember reading that prior to citing it in my brief. And I think you nailed it on the head with the purchase option agreement that was signed in December of 07. Because you have to sit and ask yourself if appellant believed, and there was some kind of consensual agreement back in 06, that why a year later, with property that she believed she still owned, she'd enter into a contract that provided that she would have an option to purchase her own property from the Warnakes over a period of a term of 10 years. And that just doesn't coincide, especially when you overlap it with an ordinary person with intelligence and prudence and diligence that would know otherwise. And then you lump in also the purchase agreement, the residential lease that uses terms like landlord and tenant. I don't think there's these documents all together, I think, total 8 pages between 2006 and 2007. We're not talking about a complicated commercial transaction. This is a very simple transaction between the parties, which I believe is distinguishable from Wake case, because it's clear that there was some indication, or a lot of indication in 2007, that she knew she didn't own the property, and now she's just trying to claim that. By not pleading it in her complaint or her amended complaint, she also has made no allegations whatsoever that she didn't sign it, that she hasn't seen it, she hasn't sufficient time to review it. There's no genuine issue of material fact there. As appellees or appellees, we have met our prima facie case on summary judgment. That burden, as Judge Moore astutely noted earlier, it shifts to the appellant, and she could not overcome that with any contradictory evidence. And that's a standard on summary judgment, and why we were entitled to that and should be entitled to it on appeal. So, any other questions at this point?
We have no further questions.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have remaining?
54 seconds. Thank you all for listening. And again, there's a question about when that statute of limitations starts to run. Is it 2006? Is it 2007? Is it 2017? Is it 2018 when she actually became aware that something was amiss between her friends and her? I think we've alleged all of the necessary elements to put a constructive trust into play here, and I believe that the court should overturn the decision on the summary judgment.
What about the argument that you didn't allege anything with regard to the 07 purchase option agreement?
Again, we didn't know anything about that until we were presented with that at the summary judgment.
But you didn't offer an affidavit in opposition?
That's correct.
Challenge that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. You are both excused, and your case is submitted. Next case this afternoon is Holland versus. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.